Money, Riches, and Wealth is sponsored by the Financial Consulate.
Say you don't need no diamond rings, and I'll be satisfied. Tell me that you want the kind of things the money just can't buy. I don't care too much for money. Money can buy me love.
This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Time now for Money, Riches, and Wealth. Here's your host, Drew Tignanelli.
This is Drew Tignanelli here. Money, Riches, and Wealth. And I have a guest tonight, but I also have a co-host here, Robert Lindstrom. Robert, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Robert wanted to be with me tonight because our guest is one of his favorite bloggers on personal finance, right?
That's right, the Humble Dollar.
The Humble Dollar, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Well, now all of our listeners know, too, and they can get that information, but we're going to talk to Jonathan Clements tonight. He wrote the book, How to Think About Money. Jonathan, are you there?
I am, Drew. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's great to have you. The very first question we want to know is, where is that accent from? England? Australia?
Well, the real story is, I was born in London, but I moved to the United States when I was age 3. In fact, I moved to Washington, D.C., and I grew up speaking with an American accent, and then my parents shipped me off to boarding school in England, and there they beat the American accent out of me. And ever since I returned to the States, 30 years ago, it's slowly been creeping back.
Yeah.
That's what lies behind the accent.
Well, that's fascinating. Because you really get a little accent, but you know it's not 100% in any way, shape, or form. So that's interesting. The thing that I really wanted to talk to you about your book, How to Think About Money, is because we have a saying in our company, and every time I do a retirement seminar for a company or a university or a corporation or something of that sort, I always start off with this. The foundation of all financial planning is what you think about money is going to determine everything you will do with and for money. And the thinking about money is probably more important than the economics of money. What do you say?
I couldn't agree more with you. Our lives are a pitched battle between the whiny demands of our current selves and the needs of our future selves. If we forever give in to the desires of our current self, we head off to the shopping mall, we don't get up in the morning and go to the gym, we eat junk food all the time, we are sacrificing our future self. And this is particularly poignant when it comes to managing money. If you're constantly living paycheck to paycheck, you're spending every dime that you earn, it may feel good in the moment, but 30 or 40 years down the road, when it comes time to quit the workforce, you're not going to be too happy. And let me emphasize this. If you are age 20, there is a greater than 90% chance that you will reach retirement age. There is a greater than 90% chance that you will be that future self. If you aren't willing to sacrifice today in order to provide for your future self, you are bitterly going to regret it down the road.
Yeah, I've been in this business for 40 years, Jonathan, and I was fascinated because I didn't learn this concept, what you think about money is going to determine everything you'll do with it for money, until around 15 or 16 years in the business. And what I found was two people, identical situations, identical, makeup and so forth, and you give them both the same exact same good advice, and I get totally different results out of the people because they think differently.
Absolutely, and I would say that probably 20% of the population have, when it comes to money, great self-control. They get it. They understand the need to delay gratification. They're the ones that max out their 401k every year. They're the ones who are never late with the bills. They always have money in their checking account. They are your model financial citizens. But for the other 80%, managing money is a real struggle. Every day, they are inclined to overspend. Often, they fail to pay the bills on time. Frequently, they don't put even enough money into their 401k plan to get the employer match, which is essentially free money. And those are the 80% who really need financial help, but all too often they just don't get it.
Jonathan, one of the first chapters you have in the book is about buying more happiness. And how can we do that with responsibly balancing this current self and future self?
Well, one of the first things to realize about spending money and happiness is that much of the time, the dollars we spend deliver very little happiness. And we can see this at a macroeconomic level if we look at something called the General Social Survey. The General Social Survey has been conducted every year or two since 1972. You go back to 1972, and 30% of Americans describe themselves as very happy. Fast forward to 2018, and guess what? 30% of Americans describe themselves as very happy. In the meantime, our standard of living has more than doubled. We are living more than twice as well as we were in the early 1970s, and yet our reported level of happiness is no higher. Money has not bought happiness. I believe it can, but most of the time it fails to do so because we spend it in the wrong way. And so what I'd say to people is, you may think that spending today is going to make you happier, but in all likelihood, it's not. So taking a little bit of that money and saving it for the future, frankly, the financial pain involved is not going to be that great.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. I have to take a pause in about 10 or 20 seconds, but you know that future self and current self, you know, I like to say it like this, that I want my clients to live today for today, but be absolutely certain that tomorrow is going to show up. And that's what everyone needs to think about. But right now, I've got to take a pause for traffic. We're going to be right back with Jonathan Clements.
This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate. Are you looking for a professional financial advisor that you and your family can trust and count on for the rest of your life? The Financial Consulate, being fee only, is unable to take commissions or referral fees. We are independent of stockbrokers and insurance companies and work solely as a fiduciary in your best interest. These are the key ingredients of a professional financial advisor. If you've been wanting a second opinion, then consider our trademark service, the Financial Physical. We guarantee if you don't come away from your financial physical with a sense of immense value, then there will be absolutely no charge. Call 410-823-7283 to speak with me and the team of comprehensive personal financial advisors and CPAs. That is 410-823-SAVE, or go online to financialphysical.com to learn more. That is financialphysical.com.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
All right, we're back with Jonathan Clements, and he wrote the book, How to Think About Money. You didn't just write the book, How to Think About Money, but you have an acclaimed career. You were a great writer for the Wall Street Journal for many years, weren't you? Jonathan?
Yep.
Oh, there you are. You were with the Wall Street Journal, weren't you?
That's correct. I was with the Wall Street Journal for almost 20 years. I was a personal finance columnist for the newspaper for most of that period. I've also spent time at Forbes magazine. I did a six-year stint at Citigroup, where I was the director of financial education for the U.S. wealth management business. But for the past 5 years, I've been enjoying what I call my second childhood, doing a bunch of things. I've written four books over the period. And also, as you mentioned, I now run this website called HumbleDollar.com, which aims to be a comprehensive personal finance site. We have new blogs every day, as well as a host of other material on it. If you want some free financial information, good, solid information without any sort of conflict of interest, you should check it out, HumbleDollar.com.
Well, that's great. So you have five steps in your book. So you say, buy more happiness. Robert talked to you a little bit about that. Bet on a long life. Rewire your brain. Think really, really big. To win, don't lose. And the one that fascinated me was number three, rewire your brain. And you say this. You say, Thanks to the instincts we inherited from our hunter-gatherer ancestors, we are hardwired to fail both as savers and as investors. Result, it takes great self-discipline, or in the absence of self-discipline, a certain amount of self-deception to manage money successfully.
And what's that all about?
Yeah, what is that all about? That was the question, Jonathan. I'm sitting here thinking, what do hunter-gatherers have to do with everything? But I sort of understand, but I'd like to hear your take.
So over the past couple of decades, we've seen a huge amount of research into why people behave financially in the way that they behave. And in that chapter, what I'm pulling on is a couple of different strands of that research. One, there's something called behavioral finance, which looks at some of the consistent mistakes we make when managing money. And then, in addition, there's something called neuroeconomics, where they actually look at your brain and see how it responds to different stimuli, such as the chance of a huge financial win, or conversely, what happens to your brain when you face the prospect of losing a lot of money. And then on top of that, there's something called evolutionary psychology, which tries to trace our behavior today to what our hunter-gatherer ancestors used to do. And so, for instance, one of the things that we see in the stock market a lot is that people tend to flock to investments that are super popular. You just have to go back to 2017 and all the hoopla over Bitcoin that drove Bitcoin in the course of that year from $1,000 to $19,000. Before rapidly reversing. And what was that all about? Well, we know that one of the keys to survival is to follow the crowd and make sure that you know, if you do what's popular, you'll tend to be doing the right thing. And that does work well if you're a hunter-gatherer, and it works pretty well if you're trying to pick a good restaurant or pick a movie, but it sure doesn't work well when it comes to investing. If you buy what's popular, often what you're doing is buying what's overpriced. So when we think about how we behave financially, it's useful to look at these mistakes that we make and say, okay, I'm going to manage my money in the right way. What are the pitfalls I have to overcome, and how should I really think about money?
Yeah.
Jonathan, the step that jumped out to me the most was the last one, step five, to win, don't lose. And it's kind of, I've heard other famous investors, kind of like Charlie Munger comes to mind of this kind of inverting the problem, not how do I win, but how do I don't lose. How do you think about that in terms of personal finance?
As I like to tell people, we only get one shot at making the financial journey from here to retirement, and failure is not an option. You cannot afford to mess up saving and investing over those crucial four decades that you spend in the workforce. So how are you going to make sure that you make it successfully from here to retirement? There are two aspects to that. One, you want to make sure that you don't generate lousy investment returns over that period. And the way you do that is by diversifying broadly. Diversifying broadly will ensure that you get returns that look something like the broad market averages. And if, over the course of your working career, you get something that looks like the broad market averages and you save regularly, good things will happen. But if you go out on a limb and you start betting on individual stocks, you start trading in and out of the stock market, there's every chance that you will not capture the market's return and that you will end up with a penny-pinching retirement. So the investing side and diversification is one aspect of that. Then the other aspect is to make sure your financial life doesn't get blown up because of some financial error that could have been solved with insurance. So, for instance, you need to have disability insurance. You need to have health insurance. If you've got a family that depends on you financially, you need to have life insurance. By getting the right set of insurance, again, you make sure that your family's financial life isn't blown up because of some terrible accident.
Well, you know, Jonathan, that's an interesting point that you're making there about the insurances. But one of the problems that I see, and we're, you know, being fee-only advisors, too many people get their insurance advice from insurance agents, and unfortunately, I find that they don't get very good advice.
That's a really polite way of putting it, Drew. They normally get terrible advice. If you go to,
I get screamed at enough on this show. I don't need to get too much more slack from the insurance agents of the state. Go ahead.
If you go to most disinterested observers and you say, look, we've got this young family that needs insurance. They're going to need the insurance for the sort of 18 or 20 years they raise the kids and put them through college. What should they buy? And the answer is probably what they should buy is a low-cost term insurance policy that can provide coverage for that brief period of time at a relatively low cost. And then once the financial obligation is over, you let the policy lapse.
And that way you can get the biggest policy you need, you know, that you can afford, as opposed to this junk that most of these agents sell people.
And yet, what do the agents sell? Well, this is a statistic that just blows my mind. 60% of the insurance, life insurance policies that are sold in any given year are cash value life insurance. The other 40% are term insurance. 60% are cash value life insurance. What that means is family after family across this country are paying huge premiums for a relatively small death benefit. And the only reason they've ended up with those policies is because the insurance agents involved can collect huge commissions for selling those products. They are not in the best interest of the customers. A true fiduciary would never sell them those policies, except under very rare circumstances, and yet that's what so many people end up with. And what happens? They can't afford the premiums, and so in many cases, within a few years, people let those policies lapse, they've paid those huge premiums, they've ended up with no coverage, and the only people who are wealthier are the insurance agents involved and the insurance companies that back them up.
Well, you know, we always beat up on the life insurance agents, but, you know, I'm not too much more impressed with the auto and home insurance agents either. A lot of the coverage they provide is poor compared to what the... And this time, they underinsure the people.
Well, it depends. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But in general, and maybe I'm being too kind here, but in general, agents who sell property casualty insurance, homeowners insurance, auto insurance, umbrella liability insurance, renter's insurance, tend to get people into the right ballpark. Whereas when it comes to life insurance agents, not only are they selling cash value life insurance, which is inappropriate for most people, but also they then turn around and start to try to sell people investments, and you get end up with people buying high-cost variable annuities, end up buying equity indexed annuities with long surrender charges.
Look, I agree with you, Jonathan. It's usually much worse. But let me tell you something. When 80 or 90% of my clients come into us with net worths well over $1 million with nothing more than 100, 300 of auto insurance, no umbrella liability insurance, and garbage like that time and time and time again, I'm getting just as frustrated with the auto and home insurance agents as I am in life insurance. But I have to take a pause, and then we're going to come right back, and you can comment about that. All right, you know, we got to go to traffic. Take it away, traffic.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
There you go. The Supremes. Oh, come on, you... You know, Chris, why don't you learn music for once, you know? Anyway, we're moving on. I'm moving on, Chris. You know? All right, I'm moving on. Jonathan Clements here. How to Think About Money. And page 98 and 99, you had some great things here about how people... irrational economic decisions. And I'm going to just read a few of them, and then you can take it from there. Young parents will buy auto policies with low $250 deductibles, but won't bother with buying life insurance. Folks will carry a credit card balance costing 20% while keeping cash in a savings account earning 0.01%. Employees will work 30 years at a job they hate to qualify for a traditional defined benefit pension, but they won't dream of delaying Social Security benefits for a few years to get a larger monthly check. Couples will buy lottery tickets and take vacations in Vegas, even if they steer clear of stocks because they're afraid of losing money. Those are some good ones there, Jonathan.
And so what we're talking about here is a common phenomenon. We all do it. It's called mental accounting. And what that means is think of our financial lives as a series of buckets. You know, our mortgage is distinct from our auto loan. Our auto loan is distinct from our portfolio. And essentially, we don't have a good overview of our finances. And yet, to make rational economic decisions, we do indeed need to think about our finances holistically. And when you think about your finances holistically, the key organizing principle, I believe, is what economists call your human capital and what the rest of us would call your income-earning ability. For most of us, our income-earning ability is our most valuable asset. And what we should do is we should take our human capital and organize our finances around it. And in particular, our human capital has four major implications for how we manage money. First, our human capital provides us with the savings we need to set aside for retirement and for other goals. Second, our human capital allows us to take on debt because we know that we have these years and years of paychecks ahead of us in order to pay back that loan. So if you're in your 20s, it's actually reasonably rational to take out student loans, to take out a mortgage, even to take out an auto loan, because you know that you have those four decades of paychecks ahead of you to service that debt. But as you approach retirement and the end of those four decades of paychecks, what you should look to do is pay off those debts so that you retire debt-free. Because at the point you retire, you no longer have a paycheck to service those loans. Our human capital also drives our insurance needs. We talked about it before: disability insurance, health insurance, life insurance. And then finally, and maybe most interestingly, our human capital actually drives the way we allocate our investment portfolio. You can think of your human capital as the equivalent of having a huge investment in bonds that's going to pay you this regular income during your working years. So what you want to do is diversify that human capital by investing heavily in stocks. As you approach retirement in the last of your paychecks, that's when you start shifting more towards bonds so that you have income-generating investments to replace the paycheck that you're about to lose.
Jonathan, the human capital part is, you've written before about how using that and turning that into a retirement savings is a tough, life's toughest financial task. And then once you get there, generating retirement income is the trickiest. Why is it so tricky?
When you retire, think about the financial problem that you face. The biggest part of the problem is you simply have no idea how long you're going to live. Your retirement might last 10 years. It might last 35 years. None of us know for sure. So that makes it enormously difficult to figure out how quickly we can spend down our savings. On top of that, we don't know what inflation is going to be. Are we going to have modest inflation like we have today, or are we going to see a return to the 1970s when we had double-digit inflation? And how do you plan for that? We also have to be cognizant of something called sequence of return risk. There's been a lot of research on this. If you retire and you immediately get bad financial markets, there's a grave risk that you're going to rapidly deplete your portfolio, because that combination of your own need for spending money and falling stock prices can quickly vaporize the value of your portfolio and leave you impoverished for the rest of your retirement years. So what you need to do is to make sure that you are somehow protected from that sequence return risk, and especially that big risk of a bear market early in retirement.
So, Jonathan, one of the things you mention in this book, one of the five steps, is plan for a long life, and that you're going to work longer and enjoy work. You know, do you have any tips as to how people can enjoy work? I always am amazed at how many people come to me in their 50s and early 60s, and they know they have to work another 5 or 10 years, but you can see that they're just dying on the vine, continuing to work.
Well, Drew, let me offer up a piece of unconventional wisdom, which I mention in the book, and which I spout off about whenever I get the chance, and it's this: you know, we as a society constantly tell young people that, you know, when you're in your 20s, you know, before you're burdened by family, before you're burdened by those monthly mortgage payments, what you should do is pursue your passions. I think this is complete garbage. why is it that we assume that people in their 20s should be pursuing their passions, but people in their 50s should be sitting in cubicles, you know, working like dogs? Who says that that's the right way to lead your life? I would argue it's just the opposite. If you're in your 20s, working at a conventional job can actually seem pretty exciting. The work world is new. You want to figure out the rules. You want to get those promotions and pay raises. You want to be a success. Once you get to your 50s, the work world is not enjoyable anymore. You've had enough of the office politics. You've had the promotions and the pay raises, and they really didn't change your life. Instead, what you want to do in your 50s is do the stuff that you really care about, that you're passionate about. And that's the point at which a lot of people change careers. They might shift into jobs that are perhaps less lucrative, but which they will find more fulfilling. But to be able to make that change, what you need to do is get yourself in good financial shape early on. So that's why I say to kids in their 20s, go and get a job, make a decent amount of money, save a lot, because when you get to your 40s and your 50s, you're going to want that financial freedom in order to change careers, maybe go off and launch a new business. But essentially, at that point in your life, you're going to want the freedom to spend your days the way you want rather than being beholden to the corporate world.
So let me ask you this. Is it a chicken and egg question? Which comes first, frugality or savings?
Is frugality natural to people? As I mentioned earlier, I think maybe 20% of people are truly frugal, and the other 80% really need to learn the habit of saving. But it can be learned. I do honestly believe it. And the earlier you learn it, the better off you're going
to
be.
But do you have to learn frugality first in order to save, or can you just become a saver and the frugality will follow suit?
Well, there is this whole notion of pay yourself first. If you work for a company and say they have a 401k plan and you start putting in, you know, 12 or 15% of income every month, that's a great strategy. You put in the 12-15% of your income into the 401k plan every month, and then you force yourself to live on whatever remains. The danger is that you don't force yourself to live on whatever remains, and you end up racking up the credit card debt instead. But if you can, you know, pay yourself first, put that money in the 401k or other types of savings vehicles, and then live on what remains, that's a good strategy.
Yeah. Well, we're actually headed into our final quarter or quarter of the show, I guess, right? Quarter, third, whatever, something. We're headed into the final part of our show, and that's what happens when we have a great guest, is that things move quickly. But right now I have to take one more pause with traffic. I'm going to be right back. Jonathan Clements, take it away, traffic.
This is Drew Tignanelli, host of Money, Riches, and Wealth, and president of the Financial Consulate. Are you looking for a professional financial advisor that you can trust and help you through all stages of life? Having a team of comprehensive personal financial advisors and CPAs gives us the ability to help you prepare your tax return, strategize to help you minimize tax liability, help you visualize and reach your retirement goals, and help guide you in every other facet of personal financial planning. We demonstrate these abilities every Wednesday night on our radio show, Money, Riches, and Wealth. Have you been wanting a second opinion? Then consider our trademark service, the Financial Physical. We guarantee if you don't come away from your Financial Physical with a sense of immense value, then there will be absolutely no charge. Call 410-823-7283 to speak with me and the team of comprehensive personal financial advisors and CPAs. That is 410-823-SAVE, or go online to financialphysical.com. That's financialphysical.com.
Now back to more of Money, Riches, and Wealth on Talk Radio 680 WCBM.
We're back. Money, Riches, and Wealth. We're here with Jonathan Clement. He wrote the book, at least the book we're talking about. He wrote three other books, How to Think About Money. Jonathan, why don't you tell everybody how to get in touch with you, your blog, or, you know, and so forth, learn more about what you're doing, read some of your stuff?
So if people want to read my stuff, they should head to humbledollar.com. Humbledollar.com has new material on the homepage every day, not just articles by me, but also by people who are guest contributors to the site. In addition, I put out a free weekly newsletter. If you go to the site, you can subscribe to the newsletter just by entering your email address at the top of the homepage. once you get into the site, you'll find that the core of the site is this comprehensive money guide. It runs about 500 web pages and covers every financial topic conceivable. This actually was built on a regular book I used to put out, an annually updated financial guide. I decided that it would make much more sense to put this on the web and make it freely available. So I did that a couple of years ago. So that is also available at humbledollar.com.
So I'm sure you're familiar with the quote-unquote FIRE movement. Are you familiar with that concept?
Absolutely.
Go ahead. Tell us what you think. Tell them what it stands for, and then tell them what you think about it.
So FIRE stands for Financial Independence, Retire Early. And this is a movement that has attracted people who want to save like crazy through their 20s and their early 30s with the goal of retiring as early in life as possible. You know, I've read about people who are managing to save 50% of their income. You know, these are people who engage in extreme frugality in order to escape the work world as quickly as possible. And it's become quite controversial, which strikes me as a little bit bizarre. I mean, what can be so controversial about being really, really good at saving money? But I think it's become controversial for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of discussion about the FIRE movement, and yet it's really only a strategy in its most extreme form that's available to people who make a lot of money. In fact, a lot of the people who are part of the FIRE movement tend to be very high-paid individuals who are involved in different technology businesses. You know, they work super long hours, they make a lot of money, they save a lot of money, and then often, you know, they're on the East or West Coast, and they're able to retire by selling the homes they have and moving to the middle of the country where the housing is much cheaper and the cost of living in general is much cheaper. So the FIRE movement has been criticized for being somewhat elitist. Still, I have admiration for these people. I mean, in a country where we don't have enough people saving a lot of money, anybody who's making that sort of sacrifice, I think that's admirable.
So, but quick follow-up. You also said that, you know, a lot of times when people were younger and said they saved enough money they could retire in their 40s, you had one quick question you always ask them.
The one quick question? Oh, yeah. And the quick question is this. It's like, do you have children?
Did you have children? That's right. Children change everything.
And is anybody who has kids, and I have two children and two stepchildren, anybody who's ever had a kid knows kids are expensive. Children eat money. So one of the common denominators among people who retire super early is that they tend not to have children. Though, I'll just throw this in here, I have heard complaints about the FIRE movement that one of the reasons these people, you know, save great gobs of money, retire early, and then they look relatively impoverished, and it means that their kids then get tons of financial aid when it comes time to go to college. I'm not sure how widespread that is, but that is one of the complaints I've heard about the FIRE movement.
Jonathan, I can certainly attest to the kids being expensive. I've got two little ones myself. But whether it's the FIRE movement or just like you were talking about earlier, starting off in your 20s, really trying to get off on the right foot, is there anything specific that we can do to teach our kids or teens how to think about money the right way so that they can hit the 20s going strong?
There are two things that every parent should endeavor to do. One is to set a good financial example. Your kids are far more likely to follow your example than listen to what you say. You know, even if you're at the dinner table every night, you know, pounding on the notion of saving money and investing in the stock market, if it's clear to the kids that your finances are a disaster, they're not going to listen to your advice. So for goodness sake, if you're going to talk about money, make sure that you also walk the walk. The second thing you can do, and I think this is equally powerful, is you can tell family stories that illustrate the financial values that you think are important. Family values are passed down through the generations in the stories that we tell. You should talk to your kids about the sacrifices that you made in your 20s, about the grungy apartments that you lived in, about the way you you had to scramble to make ends meet and how you got yourself into good financial shape. Because if you tell those stories, they'll listen and realize that that is what lies ahead for them, so that when they do get into the adult world and they're on their own, they're going to be prepared to sacrifice and realize that, no, they can't spend every dime that they earn, that they really should be putting away money for the future.
So, Jonathan, on page 143 of your book, you give 12 suggestions for getting the most out of your money. And we've got about 2 or 3 minutes, so why don't you hit your two top ones that you'd like to tell our listeners to get the most out of their personal financial life?
One of the things that I talk about a lot to people is the importance of holding down your fixed monthly costs. I do believe that most people want to save money. The problem is that a lot of people simply can't, because so much of their paycheck is already spoken for thanks to car payments, thanks to mortgage or rent, thanks to a litany of monthly costs that we all take on these days. You need to set yourself up to save, and the two easiest ways to do that is, one, get a house where the monthly payments aren't consuming too much of your income, and two, you know, don't buy the new car. Don't lease a car that you can't really afford to drive. Instead, buy a used car and drive that. That'll free up the money that you can then save. So hold down your fixed monthly costs. Preferably keep those fixed monthly costs to 50% or less of your pre-tax income. You'll then have discretionary spending on this or that, but it'll also free up a lot of money to save each month. One of the other things that I also try to emphasize to people is that our investment time horizon isn't measured in days or weeks or months or even years. It's measured in decades and decades. You know, thanks to our hunter-gatherer instincts, we tend to view life as being nasty, brutish, and short. But the reality is we have decades and decades to invest. And if you have that sort of time horizon, there is no better place to have your money than in a diversified portfolio of stocks. You know, if I said to you, you know, do you want to own stocks based on what's going to happen over the next week? You'd say, absolutely not. But I said, would you own stocks if you could close your eyes and open them at 3 decades from now? And you'd say, absolutely, because you'd be pretty darn confident that over those 30 years, stocks would do better than anything else out there. So somehow or other, you need to train yourself to think about investing in stocks for the long haul.
Well, you know, Jonathan, I really enjoyed reading your book because there were so many principles that we teach in our company. One of the biggest ones that we teach is money has no intrinsic power. Relationships have power. Relationships are where life and the fullness of life is found, and there was a lot of that in your book, you know. And so I really appreciated all that you said and your time for being with us today and sharing that.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show, Drew, and also you, Robert. It's been a great fun talking to you, too.
Thanks, Jonathan.
And if we ever want to have our own British accent, what's the school we have to go to learn that?
Well, I went to a boarding school in the south of England called Bryanston, and then I had 3 of the best years of my life at Cambridge University. So between those two, that's what got me this semblance of an English accent.
I don't think my American accent will ever disappear, even if I went there. But anyway, this is Drew Tignanelli saying God bless.
Show them the way you feel. Things are gonna be much better.